All right, folks. This is Mark Lee, right here at the radio show with Mark Lee. We're having a definitely interesting day here on a Monday afternoon. Hope that many of you are out there having a good time and are definitely trying to stay safe, stay protected, and all of that kind of great stuff. I know that many folks out there are getting out and about. I've actually got out of the house a couple of times. Actually got to get by the Carolina Theater because they will be doing a live version of the Eno Festival on this coming Friday. But there were some parts of it that were pre-recorded, and yours truly was checking out part of that. So don't forget that one Eno will be taking place this coming Friday evening. I'm hoping that maybe my good friend Greg will be joining us here at this conversation, and that he can tell us a little bit more about all of the great acts that will be at One Eno. But that'll be on Friday evening. I believe it's around 8 p.m. that that particular thing will be taking place. So definitely something that you may want to look into, but something that you might want to do for the 4th of July. That's right. This is the 4th of July weekend. It may not feel like it because of all of the different things that are going on in the world. We do know that there's a lot happening in the world in terms of what folks are doing and not being able to do as much as they might have done in the past, because a lot of the places that are usually busy during the 4th of July, those activities are not happening in their usual framework and in their usual way. Like I just said earlier, the Eno Festival, where I usually would be celebrating both my birthday, which would be coming up on this coming Wednesday, as well as celebrating other things that are related to the founding of the country, like the 4th of July and things of that nature, are not happening in their usual way. I know that I think fireworks are not going to be happening in a lot of municipalities because of the need to have people not close together, that whole social distancing thing that they are trying to encourage more and more people to do. So that will not be taking place in their usual framework. And like I said, I would usually be out at the Eno River and doing some of the MCing there and doing some of the work at that particular event. So that is not going to be taking place in its usual context. It will take place in another framework in another way. So that being said, we're definitely going to see how that plays out and how folks adjust to the new normal. You know, there's always this talk of the new normal, but even in the old normal, there are still some things that are happening that are on the sad note. I do know that we had a another suicide in India. I believe this was with a TikTok star, and of course, there were the recent shootings. There was a row around somebody shooting at protesters. I believe that might have been in Kentucky. So there's still a lot of very sad news going on, and there are still people that do not want to wear the mask and don't want to do the social distancing and doing other things. And we are seeing an uptick in certain states. I mean, even here in North Carolina, things have not always been all of that great in terms of the way of trying to flatten the curve, even though we're trying to change that. And of course, we do know that even in other places like Arizona, California, and other parts of the country, they are definitely becoming more of the epicenters, and we're seeing more of an uptick in their area. So do keep that in mind, that we do want everybody to be safe and cautious, and definitely keep all of that in mind as you prepare for getting out and about. Even if you're getting out and about away from your house, we do know a lot of people are doing telework and doing that whole telecommuting thing and things of that nature. So we do know that that is what is happening and is continuing to happen. So definitely hope that many of you are able to still check out what's going on and check out what's happening in the world and things along those lines. I have heard that there have been a number of the monuments that have come down and are continuing to come down, including some that might have even surprised people. Like I heard that there was a monument somewhere in this country that was dedicated to Woodrow Wilson, and apparently Woodrow had some history as well in terms of his thoughts on race relations and things of that nature. So they did take down that monument. So that is still going on as we are speaking. So there's a number of these things that are happening in society and around the world. So definitely keep that in mind. You know, just pay attention to what's happening in the world. Definitely stay informed about what's happening in the world. That's one of the things we try to do here on the radio show with Mark. So definitely trying to keep you informed about a lot of various things that are happening in our society. So do keep that in mind. And like I said, I'm hoping that my good friend Sandy Darity will be joining me in a little bit, and we can talk to him about the whole concept of reparations and what that means, and also the wealth gap. There is a definite wealth gap that exists in society, and we definitely want to address that wealth gap. So we'll be talking about that with Sandy. So definitely keep that in mind, that we would like to have that conversation going on and hear what you've got to say about that. In the meantime, though, while we're waiting to see what's going on with Sandy and when Sandy will make his appearance here on the show, we're hoping that's in the very near future. I'll reach out to him and see where he's at in regards to that. But in the meantime, I did want y'all to check out this very interesting video that I stumbled across not that long ago. It was a couple of days ago. It was a gentleman that was talking about the monuments. I know that some folks are wondering about the history of the monuments and why these monuments might be of concern to some people, and why they might be concerned about having this as an issue. So I found this particular video that I think lends a lot of insight into what is going on and why folks might be wondering about that and things of that nature. So that being said, I definitely want to share this particular document with you, let you check it out, what it's all about, and then I'll be back hopefully maybe with Sandy, or maybe we'll have some other comments from others as well. But just want you to check out this ACLU person. That's right, he is a lawyer with the ACLU, and some of the comments that he made in regards to the monument and the importance of the monument. So I'm going to play that for you right now. And then, like I said, hopefully Sandy will be back and we can continue this conversation after hearing this particular conversation that an ACLU lawyer gave about a 2 years ago or something like that. But it is still very pertinent and still very relevant even to this day.
So before I went to Guantanamo Bay, I went to Washington, D.C., and all of the lawyers in the John Adams Project were there. And we had a day-long meeting with psychiatrists and psychologists who were talking to us about trying to deal with people who had been systematically tortured. And they were telling us, you may have capital experience representing a defendant in a capital case. You may have experience representing people that have been sexually abused as children. You have never talked to a person who has been subjected to a systematic form of torture. They are damaged beyond your belief. And if you think you're going to come back the same as you were before you went down there, just throw that out the window. So it's about 4 o'clock. And to be honest with you, my thought is, where is the nearest bar? Because about 4 scotches will make me feel a lot better than I feel right now. And a woman from Indiana got up and she said, I know you feel hopeless right now. And I'm going to show you an example of the most human behavior that I have ever seen. And she showed us this video. And I want to share it with you as we end. This is a video of an actual camera safari in South Africa.
They're crouching.
She's quite big.
And what the lawyer was telling us while the video played is that when you're dealing with something powerful like the government or like white supremacy, often the victims are the smallest and the weakest.
She caught him. Oh, she did. She caught him.
And that is hopeless.
Drag him out. They're dragging
him out. Like we feel that the quagmire of race in America is hopeless.
There's a crocodile there too.
And just when you think it can't get any worse, it does. Charleston, South Carolina, and then Charlottesville, Virginia. Where does it stop?
Look at this. The crocodile's taking a baby away.
That is the definition of hopeless.
Oh, my God.
Oh, they're going to fight over it.
Oh, my God.
Look at that. Oh, he's coming
back. Huge crocodile.
Oh, look at the lions. The lions are what?
The Lions have won.
The Lions have won. Have they? Because mom and dad water buffalo went and got the whole herd. The man who has what sounds like either a British or South African accent is actually a guide. And he said that he had never seen behavior like this before. And I feel like we, as a community, as a progressive community, as a forward-thinking community, have a lot more influence than we recognize. But sometimes we just mill around because we don't know what to do. And sometimes it will take one person, just one person, to step out and do something.
Whoa.
And my suggestion is that when you do that, it actually feels good. Watch him going back. Is there some strut in his step there? He's like, get the F out of here and don't even come back. And even when that person will step out of our group and demonstrate that there are things that can be done, sometimes the group is still not ready. And it takes one other person to do something maybe a little more dramatic. And now everybody is involved. And they're like, no, don't just go away. Keep going away. And remember, it was hopeless. There was no rational way to think that this was going to succeed.
The calf's still alive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's trying to get away. It's standing up.
The lawyer in Indiana, or from Indiana, who showed us this at the end of this film said, this is the most human behavior I've ever seen, because it was hopeless and they tried anyway. So Color of Change has started a campaign to take down state-sponsored monuments to the Confederacy and to white supremacy. I urge you to go to their website, look at what they're doing, and join them in this fight. The ACLU's People Power will also be looking to organize our members and our staff so that we can move toward making America deal with a naked lunch moment about race in this country. Because by dealing with that, by taking control of the true past, we actually have a chance for a radically different future. Thank you, guys. Thank you very, very much. This is greatly appreciated. Thank you. Thank you, guys. Let's talk about Andrew Jackson, who was the architect of the Indian Removal Act. And our president, once again, we talk about rewriting history. You can't diss Andrew Jackson. He's on the $20 bill. And if he's on the $20 bill and he's a horrible, horrible person, what does that mean? Does that mean we have to take him off the $20 bill? Does that mean we have to start thinking about why we put him there in the first place? I don't want to deal with that. He's a great president. Well, these are the facts about Andrew Jackson that I'd ask you to consider. and that third one especially. And I want to give you a little bit more detail about that. But here's what our President of the United States has said about Andrew Jackson. And I'm going to read this. Had Andrew Jackson been a little bit later, you wouldn't have had the Civil War. He was a very tough person, but he had a big heart. And he was really angry that he saw what was happening with regard to the Civil War. He said, there's no reason for this. The problem with it is, the first problem, that Andrew Jackson was dead 16 years before the Civil War started. And I know it is. It's like, are you kidding me? But it's like as funny as a heart attack, because there are people who believe this. And this is part, you're saying like, oh, it's ridiculous. Nobody believes that. We are in 2017 and we're having a debate about what the Civil War meant. If you think that who controls the past is not important, you are wrong. Think about the arguments that we're having in this country today, and it's because the past has been concealed. This is one of the most amazing books you will ever see, written in 1839, Slavery as It Is. And the only thing these people did was to go to newspapers, cut out articles about slavery, and put them in a book. That's why they called it Slavery as It Is. And so I want to show you the real Andrew Jackson, because he had a slave that ran away and he wasn't having that. So he put an ad in the newspaper, Stop the Runaway, and he offered a $50 reward. That's not what I want to talk to you about. It's the end of this newspaper advertisement put in by Andrew Jackson near Nashville, state of Tennessee. And this is what it says. If you find that slave, $10 extra for every 100 lashes any person will give him to the amount of 300. When people say folks didn't fight the Civil War about slavery, they weren't about defending slavery. This is years before the Civil War. This is slavery as it is. Everyone knew that this is what slavery was about. There weren't any questions about it. I offer you these laws to get you once again to think about what slavery actually meant, and especially the law from Oregon, which I don't have the adjectives for it. So, Texas school officials are saying we want our children to learn that slavery was a side issue to the Civil War because it's divisive. We have to look forward. And President Trump is saying we need to love each other now and whatever. But we need to love each other and we have to look forward, not backward. And I get that. Looking forward is important. But if you are looking forward from a place that is false, then where you're looking forward to is the road to hell. We can't go forward without acknowledging where we have been. Let's talk about Andrew Jackson, who was the architect. What these people have forgotten is the story of King Cotton. And that's something that I will never forget. I didn't have to learn this in the past 6 years. I had to learn the true meaning, but I didn't have to learn the term, because King Cotton was part of my upbringing in Memphis, Tennessee. King Cotton was a food brand. King Cotton was on everything. There was actually a Hotel King Cotton in Memphis. Army and Navy Club, completely air conditioned, bed and halls sprinkler protected, 3-channel radio and Muzak, and overlooking the Mississippi River. This was one of the luxury hotels in Memphis. But what does the phrase King Cotton mean? What it meant to me was bacon. Because King Cotton bacon, King Cotton sausage, King Cotton like rolls. This was like the food of my childhood. Everybody in Memphis bought King Cotton brand. And when I finally found out what the name actually stood for, I felt like I wanted to throw up. Because King Cotton, the theory that was used by Southerners before the Civil War to say, we can do this. We can break away from the North and it's economically feasible. And here's why. Everybody depends on our cotton. We can shut down the mills in the North in a heartbeat. Britain and France are going to have to make a decision. Will they support us militarily? Because we can cut down their mills. We just won't send them our cotton. It couldn't have been more practically and beautifully stated than it was by Senator Henry Hammond of South Carolina. Without firing a gun, without drawing a sword, should they make war on us, we could bring the whole world to our feet. What would happen if no cotton was furnished for 3 years? England would topple headlong and carry the whole civilized world with her, save the South. No, you dare not make war on cotton. No power on earth dares to make war upon it because cotton is king. Follow the money. This is how important cotton was. What kind of money are we talking about? 1840, cotton made 59% of all U.S. exports. This is 15 years before the Civil War. 1.5 million pounds with about 700,000 slaves, and you can see how that changed. 2.25 billion pounds and almost 4 million slaves. This is what made America wealthy. This was the formation of wealth. And folks, I just want to make sure as a side note to say, I hope you don't think that the money made from slavery just dissolved and went up into the air. It went into companies and businesses, and not even tracing and blaming those corporations. Those corporations hired people and paid their salaries and their benefits and gave them the ability to raise families and to pass wealth on through the generations. This money is what made America financially stable. The market value of slaves in 1860 was greater than the market value of every railroad, factory, and bank combined. Follow the money, because the money we're talking about was huge. Think about the role of slaves and trade and slave labor in the economy. And that's a statistic that shocks me, because the Mississippi Valley today is one of the poorest places in America. And in 1860, more millionaires per capita than any other place in the country. And that was because of slavery. The white plantation owners did not have the capital to hire hundreds of workers to work these gigantic cotton plantations. They had to have free labor. And if there is any doubt about it, and let me just say, there is absolutely nothing wrong with retail jobs. But when you have an economy that is based exclusively on the exploitation of free labor, this is what happens. We are now 150 years later. There is no industry in the South that has replaced the slave trade and what could be worked on by slaves. The mayor of New York City recommended that New York not the state, the city, withdraw from the Union during the Civil War. Why was that? If you go and read, it's because we are making so much money from slavery, we want to keep doing it. If we withdraw, we can then be friends with the North, then we can be friends with the South. They are saying it to you as plainly and as directly as they can. And so the people today who say the folks honored in these monuments were not fighting for slavery, my response is, I understand that that's what you want to believe. And I understand how difficult it is to wrap your mind around the fact that human beings, fellow Americans, would fight, kill other people, and die to preserve slavery. It's really hard to wrap your mind around that, but that is the ugly truth.
All right, folks, that was some of the conversation we were having revolving around the Confederate monument with some information that I had found and everything. So definitely some great conversations that was going on and continue to go on. As I said, we've had several people that have talked about various things that have happened in society. But I'm going to switch the conversation a little bit right now. We've got my good friend Greg Vail here with us. And Greg is going to talk about what's going on. I've told him a little bit about the Eno Festival and the fact that we've moved it to Inside. And I had the pleasure of working with you Thursday and introducing a couple of the bands. But if you would talk to them a little bit about what's going on and why we're doing this. I know a lot of it has to do with the virus and things of that nature. But if you just share with them what's going on.
Hey, Mark, it's great to see you again twice in 1 week. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on. As you said, we can't come together on the banks of the river this year like we have since the 1980s. So trying to do the next best thing and come together virtually and still celebrate and hold up the great things about our community. We have a bunch of wonderful music scheduled to come in, both to the Carolina Theater, and we've gone out and recorded stuff as well. Have little short documentary film pieces made about local crafts community, about local restaurants and food vendors. We've got a camera crew over shooting at the Palace International right now with Moses and Karen and Maurice and Susanna, and just really trying to do the same kind of thing that we do at the festival, but this year inside. we've got such a wonderful community here in Durham, and just because we can't come see each other in person doesn't mean we should stop celebrating.
Yeah, there's so much to celebrate. There's so many great things that are happening in society, and even some of the hard conversations that are going on are still bringing some art out and everything, because I've noticed some of the Black Lives Matter art is downtown, and definitely some of the hard conversations are even showing that the art needs to play an important part. But whenever I think of the Eno, I think about the fact that it really was almost like came out of the environmental movement to some degree and is a celebration of the environment. So for those that are watching, we have listeners on IBM.TV from around the country and around the world that don't know that much about the Eno. I've told them a little bit about it, but you've been involved in there and on leadership for a number of years. Share a little bit about the history of the Eno and how it came about and why we might be missing doing it out there on the Eno River, but I mean, it's really a celebration of that state park and just the environment as far as I'm concerned. But I was just wondering if you could put it in the context of a little bit of the history, because we've got people that are listening from India, Australia, and places that may never have descended in this area.
Well, the Eno River is a short river. It runs about 33 miles from up northern Orange and Durham counties, and it runs into Wake County near Raleigh and joins Falls Lake. And it's pretty. It's got nice diversity in it. It was never heavily industrialized or heavily used for agricultural purposes. But what's really unique about it is that for whatever reasons, it became the focus of a lot of grassroots activism. Back in the 60s and 70s, it became a place that people decided was important to save. And because it hadn't been the subject of much damming and factories and agricultural runoff and things like that. It was still in fairly good shape, and so it's a very charismatic river. But what it means is when people got involved, like our predecessors at the River Association, there wasn't a rescue operation to preserve this river. If we could keep it from getting bad, it was already good, if that makes any sense. And so it is this beautiful, clean, pristine river running right through the middle of a heavily populated Piedmont of North Carolina. And that activism still continues today. The group I work for, the Eno River Association, has been around since 1966. We were instrumental in the creation of 5 regional parks, including West Point on the Eno, where the festival is typically held, and Eno River State Park. But what we have always done is try to involve people and be heavily boots on the ground, knocking on doors, signing petitions, making phone calls. Good old-fashioned activism, like you see in the streets in the last few weeks in Durham. That's the kind of work that we did in the environmental community. I don't mean to belittle what's happening now, because I think there's a lot more danger and a lot more at stake in the work that people are doing in the streets right now. But this was never a corporate top-down effort, is what I mean to be saying about the River Association. It was a lot of citizens who didn't like the way things were going and pushed against the authorities and made the changes. And that spirit still continues today. While we are a nonprofit 501c3 organization, we are still very grassroots. We're still very hands and feet wet in the river, and still looking for collaborators and conspirators to continue to work toward keeping these lands and waters protected for people to drink and to swim in and to go out and hike and have a place in nature to be away from the hubbub. And now, especially with quarantine and the virus and all of that the last few months, we've seen unprecedented uses of the park. I think the state park usage is up 66% over any year that records have been kept. And so these are lands that are protected for everybody forever. And just because we're stuck inside and can't see each other doesn't mean it's not an excuse to come together and celebrate what we've done in these last 50 years and what we're going to do in the next 50.
Yeah, and you're definitely doing some great work in that regards and everything. One of the things that I've really found surprising, I was wondering if you've noticed the same thing, was that as we've been going through all these different changes with what's going on with the world, particularly with the virus and everything, you just mentioned it, more people seem to be trying to get out when they can and enjoying nature. But it also seems that nature is enjoying the break from humans. So that's one of the things that I've observed is, I know they've talked about in other parts of the world, whether it's Italy or other parts, of animals that have not been seen are starting to come out. And I was wondering, are we seeing that anywhere, even here in the Durham area? Have you seen some animals that you have not seen in the past when you've had a chance to get out by the park or anything of that nature?
Well, I don't know about that, because I think I'm out a lot more, and especially, at home. I've got a garden for the first time in 20 years because I'm not having to build stages out at West Point. But I think every time I step outside, you can notice the difference just because there's so many fewer airplanes. Like I've gotten used to that now. And when I hear an airplane now, it's kind of surprising. It's like those weird days after 9/11 when the skies were empty and quiet. Although this is not quite as ominous. it's still a big change. But when I'm out in the woods, that's just one of those distractions. There's so much less traffic, just in general. It's very sad, the economic costs that these curtailments are the flip side of it. But certainly the environmental impacts are not negligible either.
Yeah, definitely. So for folks that are listening, and like I said, I've told them a little bit about some of the ones, like definitely the ones that I introduced, like Kaiki and the Hamiltones, and I told a friend of mine from South Africa about Indigo because she's a young lady. But just if you could tell us who some of the highlights are that we should be looking for on this Friday when the whole presentation is done for the Eno Festival, One Eno and everything. And also, if you could... there's so many. You just mentioned something like with the crafts, but I don't know if there are any particular highlights that you want to let folks know about that they might be quite interested in. So there's just so many in my mind, but I just didn't know if there were any in particular. And I've been a little bit unclear as to the time. I know that it starts at 8. Joe, of course, is a good friend and a great folk singer, is going to be the MC for that event. But I was just wondering, is it 8 to 11? Are we going 8 to 12? How late are we going?
Well, I was just explaining to our good friends over at WTVD, because we're not on the TV station, nobody cares exactly. We're shooting for about 11, but if we go over by a few minutes or under by a few minutes, that's just fine with us. We don't have to watch our P's and Q's. And so if the band is having a good time and they want to stretch it out and add another song, we can do all of that. We don't have to hit a certain mark. You already mentioned Joe Newberry, his good friend and often collaborator, Jim Watson, is also going to be there. People may know Jim from the Red Clay Ramblers, which was a group he started back in the early 70s. He performed at the very first festivals for the Eno and the Folklife Festival. Even before that, he was a part of the early string band revival in this area, hugely influential, and has one of my favorite voices ever to listen to. He does a great show every winter that's a Christmas Carol sing-along that I keep joking that he should do that. We can call it Christmas in July, but so far I think he's not going there. Who else do we have on Friday night? We've got Sonny Miles, who's an amazing young talent from, he's living in Raleigh now, I believe he's from up northeast somewhere. I'm thinking Wilson, NC State graduate, wonderful R&B, soul singer. One of his songs was on President Obama's top list from last year, the top Spotify list. Who else do we have next week? We've got Dwight Hawkins, who's a string band aficionado. Besides whoever the folks that are live in the studio, we've got recorded sequences. So, for example, last week we drove up to Roxborough with Lakota John and sat and visited with John D. Holman for a while at his sister-in-law's house up there and recorded some songs, and that'll be a part of it. And then, as you said, the whole craft and food, all of those pieces will be a part as well. And speaking of food, starting at 3 o'clock, so the broadcast is at 8, as you said, but starting at 3 o'clock in the plaza outside the Carolina Theater, there will be a booth set up selling the famous, you know, River t-shirts and hats and posters and things like that. But we'll also have some food trucks will be there. I know that we've got the empanada truck is there. Durham Street Food is coming. I'm not sure who else yet, but we'll check the website for updates throughout the week. And then the Carolina Theater will be selling popcorn and concessions to go. So anytime after 3, you can stop by and get some of your food fix on, as well as t-shirts and all that kind of stuff if you like. And again, even though it's a live broadcast, it's not open to the public because it's COVID regulations, but it is free to watch online. It'll be streaming on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitch for all you youngsters out there. And then it'll show again the following night, so Friday and Saturday at 8 o'clock.
Oh, wow. So that's going to be some really exciting things for them to check out. If they've got that opportunity, they'll be able to see all that great stuff. Now, how are we handling the food? Because like I said, usually I'm so glad to be there and get that great food in the area by one of the stages or grabbing it from one of the food vendors. But how are folks going to be involved with the food since they're going to be watching it from their home? But how are the food vendors be involved with the audience? And also, I think that we're selling some of the crafts. Is that the way we're trying to tie them into some of the craft communities? So when you go to the festival, you usually are able to do all of that in person. So how are some of the ways that folks will be able to actually enjoy some of these great things that happen at the festival?
Well, we will, there'll be, as a part of the show, several documentaries about local craft artists. There's a wonderful film that we just made about the aluminum pour at Liberty Arts. last week that Loris Farmer is helping us kind of host through. And then if you go to our website, there's a list of links of local craft artists and galleries and guilds and suppliers like Playmakers, that's there for all of your craft needs. If you want to make something or you want to buy something or you want to learn how to make something, we've got all those resources there. And then similarly with the food, by this weekend, there'll be a fairly robust section of food up on the website. We're going to have recipes up from Palace International and Jamaica Jamaica and Vimalo's and Ninth Street Bakery, and links to all of the locally owned restaurants. And then again, documentaries about what it's like to run a restaurant right now and the ways people are having to adapt. If you can't have a dining room full of people, how are you going to keep your restaurant open? And people are coming up with some great and creative ways to do that. For example, the Palace International is doing cooking lessons or selling spices. And of course they're doing food to go. And there's just so many great success stories about the resilience of our community and people banding together and finding solutions and figuring out ways to keep each other engaged and employed and occupied. And we just hope to be able to share some of those stories.
And doing a great job of sharing those stories. There's no doubt about that. I was wondering, is there any speculation as to what kind of ways the Eno River Association, as well as hopefully next year, the Eno Festival will continue to be engaged? Because like I said, I know that we're doing this year because of what's going on with the virus. A lot of our doctors are talking about a year, maybe even a year and a half, 2 years till we're actually back to normal. So what are some of your speculations as to how we're going to stay engaged and stay involved, even with like the Eno River Association, because the association plays such a vital role in trying to develop those properties that have been out there, those environmental properties. So if you'll share a little bit about how many lands we've rescued and also how people can stay engaged. And you mentioned it earlier that some people are actually going out to the park and keeping their social distancing and getting out there fishing and doing other things that they can do out in the park. But what are some of the other ways that people can use this time and also be engaged with the Eno River area?
Well, the Eno River Association has a full-time director of land protection, and she's working through all of this. She's meeting with landowners and meeting with state and local governments, trying to figure out, you know, if a property's up for sale, how that can be protected, whether we've got the money that we can put together the money to buy it, or to sometimes we buy what's called an easement on it, where we might pay the landowner a certain amount of money for some of the rights. For example, you might buy the right to the timber so that you couldn't clear cut it all the way down to the river. Or you might buy the right that it ever become developed, so it has to stay a farm, things like that. And so through all of this, she and her staff and her volunteers are still plugging away, working hard to develop not just close near strategies, but long-term strategies for protecting this land. Land protection is not a quick thing, like any meaningful progress or protection. It is a long, slow process. It's often years or even decades from the time we first start talking to a landowner about their property to the time that that property is protected and becomes part of a park or otherwise something that we can take credit for. So far, we've protected over 7,500 acres of land, those five parks, as well as some that we run ourselves. If you're looking for, don't tell anybody, but if you're looking for a place to get away from the crowds, we've got a 200-acre nature preserve up in northern Orange County called the Confluence, the Eno Confluence, which you can find on our website, enoriver.org. And it's got a lot of visitors, but it's not anywhere as crowded as the local parks, mainly because it just opened. We were not open when all of this quarantine started, and we hurried things up and built some trails and finished up some infrastructure so it could safely be open to the public. And now it's open 7 days a week and pretty much always has 20 or 30 cars up there. But that's not nearly as crowded as West Point or the City Park, which often are having to turn away cars, especially the State Park is getting so full on weekends that they can't accommodate any more people. So all of these properties are linked on our website, enoriver.org, with directions and brief descriptions of the amenities that are there and things like that. You know, any of these parks, please don't pollute. And know that, you know, things like the bathrooms may or may not be open depending on what's going on with the public health.
Yeah, definitely. Sounds like you're doing some great work there. And as always, Greg, just for those that are listening and don't know you that well, like I said, we've known each other for a number of years. How did you first get involved in the Eno, and what was your own initial involvement with just this whole, both the festival as well as just the whole entertainment and doing the festival? Because you've done it for a number of years. I know I've emceed for a few years and many years, and I don't even know how many. I've lost track. But I was just wondering how you got involved and what your own involvement was, and what brought you to the Eno River Association and being the festival director for these number of years?
Well, I grew up in the area, and as a child attended some of those first festivals. And then in high school, some of my friends and bands started performing at the Eno. And then when I got a little older, I started being in bands myself, and I started performing there because that's just what it seemed like you did if you're a musician around here. It was a way you gave back to the community, was you go and perform at the festival for the Eno. And even then they paid everybody. It wasn't a huge amount, but it was always a great time. And so I went from performing to volunteering to emceeing, and I don't know, one thing led to another. In the year 2000, I got hired to be the director of the festival, and I've done it since then. So I've coordinated, though this will be my 21st out of 41 festivals that I've been on the staff for.
Well, I think that you've done a great job, and I think that you should do another 21 or 22 or however many, because I've just always thought you've done a fantastic job. There have been some amazing performances that I have always told friends of mine about that I remember, that you definitely helped bring some of these folks in. Definitely, we know that Chuck Davis, when he was living, always gave a great performance. I even think back to like some of the blues folks. You talk about John D. Holman, and I think about the number of times that he's performed there, and Lightning Wells, and even there was a band that had a real high energy, Albanac, I think they were. They gave like that really high energy performance. A couple of the Latin bands that have performed there. So just a wide variety of styles of music. But those are just some of those that I reflect on as having a great time of listening to.
Well, we it's always a great pleasure working with you, and you keep those standards so high on the meta stage that I make sure, I know you won't tolerate any slack over there. So I have to make sure everything we bring to your stage has got a certain professionalism and appeal to it.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, well, it's been the
middle
stage or the growth stage. I think you've done some on the river stage as well. And as you know, I've been saying for the last, I guess, 10 or 15 years of my many years of introducing bands and everything, folks think they're coming there for a Independence Day celebration or the celebration of the nation's birth or the celebration of this or that. But it's really just nothing but Mark Lee's big birthday party. Cause, like I said, my birthday is usually right around that time, July 1st. So it's just a big birthday party for me. So I'm sure that you let all those people know that, whether it's the volunteers or whatever, that they're really just there to celebrate my birthday. They think they're there for a festival.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear you, Mark. When is your birthday?
July 1st.
Got it. Yes. Mark Lee's birthday is July 1st. Okay.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure I have it right.
Yep. Yeah. And usually the festival either falls a couple of days. I think a couple of times it's actually fallen on my birthday, depending on how the weekends fall and things of that nature. And then definitely it's at least a day or two near the birthday. So that's why I've been joking for years now that the Eno Festival is just one big birthday party for me.
Well, you well deserve it, Mark.
Well,
thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, yeah. Glad to have you on. And just real quickly, if there are anything that you want to share with the audience about any other things in terms of a word of encouragement as we're going through all of these different things that we're going through. And also, if you will just tell them once again where they can find the concert when it takes place, the one, you know. So if you'll let them know the different locations. I know we're on YouTube, Twitch, and I forget the rest of the platforms, but you'll let them know how they can find us on Friday evening. And also, like I said, if you've got any words of encouragement or any other highlight that you want to highlight other than the ones that you've mentioned, that would be appreciated. But other than that, I'll let you go. But I definitely want you to come on and let folks know what was happening.
Well, I can't imagine being any more proud to be a part of a area and a community that than we all should be in Durham, the way we've all handled this, from wearing masks to getting along to making some really, really significant changes to continuing to keep our local economy going. It's really remarkable what all we have done here together. And it's not over yet, and we need to keep doing this. But it's something. We are very lucky to have each other. And as far as the business at hand, the easiest way to follow what's going on with us next weekend is go to our website, which is enofest.org or enoriver.org. And everything will be linked from there, all the socials and whatever. And it'll stream there. Your best signal will be on the YouTube, but it's easiest to just follow a link from our website.
Sounds great. I'm looking forward to checking it out on Friday evening. I'll be definitely watching as well. Like I said, we did some of the pre-recording parts that I was involved in, so I'll see how that all came out and everything. I'm going to miss being out there in the park and running into my friends and seeing you and Paul and the rest of everybody out there. And hopefully next year in 2021, even though some of my medical experts are telling me, don't hold your breath, it might be 2022, but definitely, hopefully in 2021, we'll be able to be out in the park and be out in our normal environments. But we'll do whatever the experts tell us to do, because we definitely have to follow the rules and follow the orders and try to flatten this curve and make sure that everything's done in the correct way. And I'm sure that whatever way is done, you're going to have to come up with some innovative ways to even restage it whenever we do get outside, whenever that is. Oh, Greg hit the mute button. there you go.
There we go. All right. Well, Mark, thanks again for having me on.
No problem. Definitely look forward to seeing you out and about somewhere in the great city of Durham or around the Triangle. And like I was telling the rest of the listeners, hopefully in the not too distant future, we'll be able to have the festival the way that we're used to having it, but we want to make sure that we do it correctly. So I think that this is a great solution. I know when you reached out to me and Rebecca and other people in the community were like, how can we have the festival? And this whole virtual concept is one way that we can keep that tradition going. And I know that you've done a great job in putting it together. So I just wanted to salute you for the great job that you've done in helping to put this whole effort together. And like I said, I look forward to seeing it on Friday. I know it'll be a fantastic presentation, but the parts that I've seen already, I know that you've done a smoking good job.
Well, it takes a village. Thank you, Mark. We'll see you soon.
See you. All right. Well, that was Greg Bale. He's the person that puts together the Eno River Festival in terms of getting the music and just getting that whole thing running and keeping it running on a regular basis. As you heard him say, this will be his 21st year doing this. So he's definitely been involved with it for a number of years and has definitely been a great participant in terms of celebrating the community, celebrating the environment, celebrating all of these great things that happen in our community on a regular basis. So definitely want you to think about going to that event on Friday. Like I said, it will be an online event, so hopefully you'll be able to attend that event and check it out. So that's one of the things that is going on in the community. Like I said, we do still have a number of things that happen in the community, even when things are not happening in their usual way and form or fashion. So that being said, definitely there's some great conversations that have been had in that regard and things of that nature. So definitely want to let you know that that's what's happening with that. Still waiting to see if I can get Sandy on and everything. But in the meantime, while I'm looking to see if I can get him on, I have dug up a YouTube that he did some time back about the racial wealth gap. So I want to hopefully we'll get him on and he can talk some more about what this is all about and things of that nature. but I do want you to be able to check out what he's got happening and some of what this is all about and things along that line. So that being said, I'm going to see if I can't bring this up as well, which is Sandy's conversation around the wealth gap. And like I said, I'm hoping that Sandy will be joining me live and in person as well. So definitely, I hope that everybody out there is hearing these great things that are happening in our community and that they will continue to be involved with what's going on in the community, no matter what these various things are. So definitely hope that many of you will continue to pay attention to what's happening on in the world and around the world, because we do know that a number of things are going on in our society that we need to pay attention to. So I'm here to have Sandy bring up this TED talk that he had, and I'm gonna see if I can't get Sandy to come on board live and in person as well. So we're gonna see if we can't get Sandy's TED talk up right now. But in the meantime, I'm gonna reach out to him and see if we can't find them as well. But definitely, this is a conversation that's been going on for a while. I'm wanting to hear Sandy's version of what's happening, and definitely we're getting ready to bring that on very shortly. So hopefully you folks will enjoy the information that you're about to learn from Sandy and the TED Talk that he gave. But in the meantime, I'm going to reach out to him and see if we can't find them as well.
So I'd like to invite you to join me in seeing a world where every young person can succeed regardless of their parents' financial circumstances. Imagine, if you will, a world where every young person can expect to have a college education if they would like to. Imagine a world where every young person could become an owner of a place to live, if they so desire. And imagine a world where every young person could become an entrepreneur, if that is their dream. The absence of family wealth creates an obstacle for young people to achieve those kinds of goals and aims. Indeed, we could argue that the absence of family wealth creates a situation in which young people have shuttered opportunities. And we can do something about this, but we have to be bold in taking action. What I would like to propose is a policy that's been developed by a growing team of researchers under my leadership in collaboration with Derek Hamilton at the New School. And the idea is to provide every newborn infant with what we would like to call a trust fund or a custodial fund. But it would be a trust fund or a custodial fund that would be financed by the federal government. So in effect, it would be a publicly financed custodial fund. The idea is the following: that every child would receive this fund at birth and would have access to it when they reach maturity, say at the age of 18 or 21. Why would we do this? Because what we would be attempting to do is to offset the financial disadvantages that they might incur if they come from families with limited assets. So in the standard stump speech that I give about these set of ideas, I argue that since this would be a universal program, we would give $500 to kids who are born at the upper end of the wealth distribution. But for children who are born into families at the lowest end of the wealth distribution, we would give them an award of approximately $50,000 to $60,000. And because young people would know that they would have access to this publicly provided financial asset from a very young age, it would function psychologically as an asset as opposed to a lottery winning. And it would make it possible for young people to begin to imagine a future in which they have a set of resources that would facilitate their dreams and possibilities. Now, why is the focus of this particular initiative on wealth instead of income? Well, let me begin by trying to define wealth for you to distinguish it from income. So wealth is the difference between what you own and what you owe. It's the difference between the value of your assets and the value of your liabilities. It is the net worth that you possess or the net value of your personal property. And it provides a set of options that are not provided by income, which is a flow of resources that's predominantly determined by your earnings. So if we think about the situation that is associated with higher levels of wealth, we can think about a range of facets of economic security that are very, very critical to our lives. Let me start with the example of financial emergencies. Suppose a family loses the job, or suppose a family incurs a catastrophic illness. These are significant and dramatic effects on the family's capacity to provide for itself. And as a consequence, if you have a significant amount of wealth or an adequate amount of wealth, those kinds of emergencies are not going to be as dramatic. And keep in mind that the average family in the United States has less of an ability to meet emergencies than we might typically imagine. For example, the average American family, if it's faced with $500 of additional expenses, cannot meet those expenses without going into debt. In addition, if we think about the capacities that wealth gives us in other arenas, the ability to purchase a home, the ability to purchase a home in a neighborhood that has high cachet public schools, or to send one's kids to a private school. Wealth provides the ability to engage actively in the political system in a country that relies heavily upon financial contributions to politicians for them to be successful. Wealth also enables individuals to give to leave bequests for their children and for their grandchildren. It also enables them to provide gifts during the course of their own lifetimes, what we call in more technical jargon, in vivo transfers. So wealth is an enabling dimension of people's lives that we are thinking we should give all young people access to. Now, let me talk briefly about how significant these wealth disparities are across our society and how little some groups in our society have. Now, I've already pointed out that the typical family cannot meet $500 in additional expenses without having to accumulate new debt. It's also the case that individuals who are homeless, approximately 50% of people who are homeless, actually have a job, but they don't have adequate resources to provide themselves with sufficient shelter. So if wealth was distributed in a more equal fashion, they would have a capacity to live in a more economic secure context. Now, I also want to emphasize that these kinds of adverse effects of wealth inequality actually are even more pronounced when we look at the Black American community. It's interesting to note how dramatic the differences are between Black and white wealth in the United States. The typical Black family has 20 cents to the dollar of net worth that the typical white family has in its possession. And if we think about the actual numbers here,
I just went on there and worked and everything on the second one that I sent you. But we can just shoot for either next week or the week after. But this is something I do every Monday. But I can definitely try to get you on in the future.
A $176,000.
Oh, no, no problem.
White families in the middle of the wealth distribution for all white households.
Yeah.
That's a very
no. Monday is Friday, so difference. Monday is the 6th. So you're saying the 13th, which is the following
standard
Monday.
Ways that people think about. This. Right. So one of right. the obvious explanations that people give for these kinds of dramatic or glaring
all right. disparities wish you put a 13th.
Is to argue that it must be attributable to
the yeah, fact
that
link.
Black folks
no, I'll see,
are
yeah, I'll send you the link, like,
eager
in the next
to acquire
day or two.
Education, and so education.
And no, I'm saying I will.
Amount of wealth. Here's the key point, though. We found that blacks with a college degree actually have 2/3 of the net worth of whites who have never finished high school. Another argument that's made is, well, wealth tracks income. So if we looked at black folks with higher levels of income, they would have comparable levels of wealth with whites. This isn't true either. Black Americans whose incomes fall in the middle of the American income distribution have lower levels of wealth than whites who are in the poorest 20% of the American wealth, the American income distribution. Some people say it's because of a lack of financial literacy, but there's absolutely no evidence to demonstrate that people at comparable levels of income, black or white, have very different degrees of financial literacy. But if they are black or white, they have very different levels of wealth. Finally, some people have argued that these kinds of disparities are attributable to family structure differences between blacks and whites. Well, the evidence, on the other hand, tells us that black families with two parents have 2.5 times less of the wealth than white families with a single parent. So we have to craft a very different narrative to explain these kinds of disparities. And the narrative that I would like to craft focuses on the historical conditions in the United States, historical conditions that are associated with the way in which white supremacy has played out in this country. So I would begin that narrative by talking about the failure to provide Black Americans with 40 acres that were promised in the aftermath of the Civil War. That's the beginning of the process of distinctive racial patterns of wealth inequality in the United States. The second thing that occurs is a process of seizure and appropriation of land that actually was accumulated by Black Americans between the end of the 19th century and then the early part of the 20th century. But to compound that, there was a series of white massacres that were conducted across the country in the interval between 1868 and the 1940s that led to vast amounts of destruction of Black property, especially in communities in which there was evidence of Black prosperity. One of the strongest examples is the case that has occurred in North Carolina, in Wilmington in 1898. And perhaps the most dramatic example was Tulsa, Oklahoma in 1921, in which white rioters actually dropped incendiary devices from airplanes onto the Greenwood community, the Black neighborhood in Tulsa, Oklahoma. But subsequently, there were other ways in which prosperous Black communities were actually damaged or destroyed. And these ways were less obvious than the sheer violence that was executed in these white massacres. The ways in which this occurred are ways that actually apply to Durham, North Carolina. And this is by the process of the construction of a federal highway system that frequently ran routes directly through the heart of Black business districts across America. And the specific instance in the Durham context is the destruction of the Hayti district by the creation of Highway 147. In addition, you know, things are not good, but they get worse. Okay. In addition, there was a set of public policies that were adopted in the aftermath of World War II that were the strongest attempts in the United States in the history of the United States to produce greater social mobility. And these public policies included the GI Bill and a federal subsidy program to assist people in becoming homeowners. These two pieces of legislation had the strongest impact on providing individuals in the United States with the opportunity to move upward to the middle class. Well, what went wrong? What went wrong is the decentralized administration of these policies led to vast underutilization on the part of Blacks and vast overutilization on the part of whites, so that you did not have the same kinds of benefits flowing to both communities. And so as a consequence, you widened the wealth gap. And by the decentralization, I'm talking about the capacity of local Southern administrators to make the decision about which veterans would have access to the full benefits associated with the GI Bill, and to make decisions about who would have access to the types of loans that would support mortgage payments. So that's the story I would like to tell about why we have the racial wealth gap. I'd like to add at this point that what I've really given you is a narrative about why we should have reparations. Okay. What I would like to talk about today is why the baby trust proposal might make some headway in addressing not only general wealth inequality in the United States, but to some degree, racial wealth inequality. Here's the key point about that. Two researchers at the Brookings Institution, Richard Reeves and Isabel Sawhill, have made a distinction between race-conscious and race-unconscious policies. Now, race-conscious policies are not necessarily race-specific policies. So I want to be very clear about this. Reparations as a program to address the history of injustice against African Americans is a race-specific program. But the Baby Trust is a program for all American infants. It is, however, in addition to being race-neutral, it is also race-conscious in the following sense. A race-neutral policy that can be race-conscious is one that addresses the needs of a particular community more intensely than another because that community is disproportionately deprived. So the fact that Black wealth is so much lower than white wealth on average means that a program that would distribute wealth to young people on the basis of their family's financial resources would have a disproportionate benefit for Black youths. It would not close the Black-white wealth gap. That would require reparations, but it would certainly create a wider range of opportunities for our young people. This is a bold policy initiative, and I think it's important that we continue to craft ideas that break with the status quo, not just incrementally change the status quo. I've said at a different point in time that unless we have people who think about ways in which we can produce dramatic change, we will not have dramatic change. I'm William Darity, and I like to count myself among those who think about making dramatic change.
There's no doubt that William Darity is definitely one of those that is one to make dramatic change and definitely one to encourage folks to make dramatic change. Like I said, I was hoping that I would get a chance to have him in the studios with us today, but that did not quite happen. But I did pull off having a conversation with Greg Bale about the Eno Festival, and we did have some very enlightening conversation about what's going on in terms of some reflections on both reparations and the Confederate monument. So definitely had some interesting information I was able to pull down from some of the speeches that various folks gave, one being Sandy Darity, of course, and of course, the ACLU lawyer talking about the Confederate monuments. And then, of course, I had Greg Bell talking about what was going on with the Hino Festival, which is an environmental type festival and came out of the environmental movement, but definitely was a very powerful conversation with him as well. We'll be back next week with some more great conversations. As a matter of fact, I can tell you who we've got coming up next week as well. So I'll have to remember who that is. Oh, that's right. We've got a conversation once again about inclusion. I believe that's the one with Stephanie Johnson, who wrote a book called Inclusify. So I believe she is scheduled for the 6th, as well as a couple of other guests that are also scheduled to be on our show as well. So definitely hope to see many of you out and about. Yes, I still try to get out and about if it ain't nothing but to a restaurant or something like that. But definitely hope to see many of you at things of that nature. I'm going to be right there Friday, right here in front of this TV, watching the One Eno celebration. Like I said, I did some parts on that, and Joe Newberry will do the main hosting. But it was a fun of the activities that I was part of in terms of some pre-recording, and I really enjoyed it and really enjoyed having the opportunity to talk to Greg today. But we're going to try to reschedule Sandy for a later time, but I definitely think we gave you some things to reflect on and to think about. But right now I'm here to call it a particular evening, but I will be back later on this evening. That's right, at 7 o'clock, 7 to 9, we've got our other show, Straight Talk with Dean and Mark. So that show will be coming your way 7 to 9. I've got some musicians that'll be on that show, Tony O as well as Elodie. And then we've also got a parenting activist that is scheduled to be on the show, and some other great guests as well. So should be a fun conversation, and I hope that you will join us at that time. That is 7 to 9 on blogtalkradio.com/squared807. So definitely keep your ears on that particular outlet. You know, it's not as much of a verbal outlet, it's more of an audio outlet. So definitely keep your ears on that one, and we will be back with that very shortly in the evening. So in about another it's almost 3:30, so in about another 3.5 hours that will be taking place. But in the meantime, I hope that you'll reflect on some of the things that you heard today, some of the things that you learned today, and that there are definitely some things that you will think about as you go about your day. And whatever you do, get out there, be safe. Be cautious of what other people are doing as well. Be sure to wear those masks if you're going out and out and about. You know, those masks are very important, as is the whole socially distancing aspect. So definitely, you know, try to keep your space, but, you know, still engage with people. So socially distancing may not be the actual best term to call it, because we do want you to still engage with folks, but we do want you to maintain some distance so that we can continue to try to flatten the curve around the country as we fight this pandemic. But I'm Mark Lee. I'll be definitely seeing you at some other IBM.TV events, and we'll be back here next week with our show. Hope that everybody out there has a great time. And like I said, we'll be back next week with some more engaging conversation.